And we'll read from verses 1 to 13. Now he was also saying to the disciples, there was a certain rich man who had a steward, and this steward was reported to him as squandering his possessions. And he called him and said to him, what is this I hear about you? Give an account of your stewardship, or you can no longer be steward. Now we've seen this a number of times of men being called to give an account by the master, and that's the case here. Verse 3, the steward said to himself, what shall I do since my master is taking the stewardship away from me? I'm not strong enough to dig. I'm ashamed to beg. I know what I shall do so that when I am removed from the stewardship, they will receive me into their homes. And he summoned each one of his master's debtors, and he began saying to the first, how much do you owe my master? And he said, 100 measures of oil. And he said to him, take your bill and sit down quickly and write 50. Then he said to another, and how much do you owe? And he said, 100 measures of wheat. He said to him, take your bill and write 80. And his master praised the unrighteous steward because he acted shrewdly. For the sons of this age are more shrewd in relation to their own kind than the sons of light. And I say to you, make friends for yourselves by means of the mammon of unrighteousness, that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal dwellings. He who is faithful in a very little thing is faithful also in much. And he who is unrighteous in a very little thing is unrighteous also in much. If therefore you have not been faithful in the use of unrighteous mammon, who will entrust the true riches to you? And if you have not been faithful in the use of that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will hold to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. We're told many things in the Old Testament concerning the coming Messiah. We're told where he would be born. We're told details about his life. We're told the way that he would die. We're told what lineage he would come from. Many things like that. One of the things that we're told is how he would teach. We're told in the Old Testament that when the Messiah would come, he would open his mouth in parables, and he would utter things that had been hidden from the foundation of the world. And we have been seeing in recent weeks and months that that is certainly true of the teaching of the Lord Jesus Christ. I have been aware of a lot of parables, but whenever I really began to look into this and think of, well, you know, why don't I just speak on the parables? Well, that's saying a lot, because there are a lot of parables that Jesus gave, and here he is giving another parable. We've seen that his teaching is really characterized, in many ways, is characterized by parables and by pictures and by metaphors and illustrations. Parables about the kingdom of heaven, parables about growth, parables about forgiveness, all different kinds of parables, parables about grace and so on. Last week, we looked at a parable about riches from Luke chapter 12, and that's the parable of the rich fool. And I thought it might be profitable then for us to continue this morning with another parable about riches, and about money and about mammon. And that is this parable, which is often wrongly called the parable of the unjust steward. That's the way that it's usually thought of, the parable of the unjust steward. This is an unusual parable And it has caused a lot of problems because the hero of the story is a crook. And the person that we're supposed to imitate is a crook. And so it presents some questions for us. He's supposed to be a role model to us. And the question is, how can that be? And I think that this will become apparent. I hope it will as we go along. But let's just start out here. Verse 1, Jesus was saying to his disciples, "There was a certain rich man who had a steward, and this steward was reported to him as squandering his possessions." Now, this I hope I can convey a little bit of how this has become fresh to me. This is revolutionary and life-changing. It really is. God is the rich man, and we are all only stewards. The steward is called upon to handle and manipulate money that isn't his. And he's responsible for that, but the money is not his. It's the rich man's money. That's the whole situation here. We talk wrongly about some people being rich. Well, there is only one rich man in this parable. The steward was not rich. He was responsible for a lot of money, though, you see. But the owner was the rich man. Bill Gates, I think Ian was saying that he's no longer the richest man in the world. He's dropped behind. But he, it was said, and I don't know if this is true or not, but it was said that you could figure it out. It wouldn't be too hard to figure it out. But it was said that he's making so much money that if he saw a $100 bill in the grass, and he had to stop making the money that he's making all the time to do this, that it would not be worth his time to go over and pick up a $100 bill because he's making more money than that every second, you see. Well, like I said, you could figure it up and see if that's really an accurate illustration, but think of this. Now, the question is, do we realize that it is really true that he doesn't own any of that money? None of it is his. None of it is his. Every resource, everything that we have, none of it belongs to us. And I can prove that by the fact that it's going to be taken away in a little while. The Bible presents it as being on loan. And that means it's something that you have temporarily that you're responsible. Now, see how true this is? Not just a little picture. It's really true. It's obvious. It's provable. It's something that you've got temporarily, and you're responsible to use that in a way that pleases the true owner until he takes it away from you. That's all that's happening. And that's happening not only to Bill Gates, but every one of us. That's God's money. And in Bill Gates' case, as in our case, he's just a steward of it. He's a very poor steward of it. And one day, he will be called to give an account, as every one of us will be called to give an account. We're going to be called to give an account of how we've used that which doesn't belong to us. Now, that's talking about not just money, but our brains and our bodies and our every resource that has been given to us. It's temporary. And God has put that in our charge as stewards. And someday we'll be called to give an account. And notice what the charge is here. The charge is that he squandered this money. And that is a very instructive thing. The problem was not dishonesty, and the problem was not embezzlement, that type of thing. This man hadn't done that, as far as we know. The problem was wastefulness, mismanagement, and misuse. Now, isn't that something? Mismanagement and misuse. Being entrusted by a rich man to manage his riches for his purposes for a time, and then wasting and misdirecting their use during the brief time that he's given them to us. That's the charge that's being brought here. And so the question is, applying it to ourselves, do I realize that everything I have is on loan to me, it belongs to someone else, and I'm going to be held accountable if I mismanage it and don't do with it wisely according to what the one who has given it to me temporarily wants me to do with it? That's the situation that we have here. So verses 2 to 7. And he called him and said to him, "What is this I hear about you? Give an account of your stewardship, or you can no longer be steward." And the steward said to himself, "What shall I do, since my master is taking the stewardship away from me? I am not strong enough to dig. I am ashamed to beg. I know what I shall do, so that when I am removed from the stewardship, they will receive me into their homes." And he summoned each one of his master's debtors, and he began saying to the first, "How much do you owe my master?" And he said, 100 measures of oil. And he said to him, "Take your bill, and sit down quickly, and write 50. Then he said to another, now he's not talking about writing out a check here for 50. We'll get to this. He said to another, "And how much do you owe?" And he said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said to him, "Take your bill and write 80. What do we have here in this situation? Well, first of all, there's a rich landowner. And then there is a steward or manager that he has put in charge of his finances. And this manager or steward is evidently not a slave. He's a free man. In fact, whenever he loses his job, it's, you know, we've read some of these parables about slaves. It says, cut him up. You know, I mean, that was a different story if you were a slave. This man was evidently a free man. And what happened was he was going to get put out of his stewardship. He didn't have any job, didn't have anything he could do, but he wasn't going to be killed or put in prison or something. He was going to be put out of his stewardship. Again, we see that apparently he hadn't been stealing, he hadn't been embezzling, or he would have been thrown in jail. In fact, he just lost his job for mismanagement. Now, you see what Jesus is saying to us? Mismanagement. That was the problem here. And these debtors, he talks about summoning his master's debtors. These debtors were apparently renters of the land. And when they were paying the landowner, you see how they paid. They paid in kind, whatever it was they grew. Like, I owe so much wheat, or I owe so much oil. You see, in other words, part of the produce of the land went back to the landowner. And so that's the situation that you have here. And these debtors, they were paying in kind rather than in money, these debtors had signed some kind of a promissory note. And here it's called a bill. It's translated bill. Actually, a lot of different ways you could translate it. But they had signed some kind of a promissory note saying that they were going to pay a certain amount of their produce to the landowner. So that was the situation. What the steward did was let them rewrite the note of what they owed the master. And so when he says, sit down and write such and such, they rewrite this thing. And so the old one's torn up, however they would do it. And it may be that this thing, not only for the debt they had this year, but for their rent. I mean, it's like I promised to pay such and such amount of rent when you sign a lease per month. Well, rewrite that. It not only helps you this year, it helps you next year too. And so this makes ongoing friends. And the debtors may not have realized that what this steward was doing was dishonest. They may have thought that he had convinced the master to lower the terms of the agreement. And evidently, from what we know of the period, That was something that was done. Sometimes when the crops were bad and that kind of thing, they would lower the amount. And so they may not have realized at all that they were dealing with an unrighteous steward here in this case. And so they no doubt went away from this thing, praising not only the steward, but praising the landowner. And so the landowner, when he comes on this situation and finds out about it, he was probably hesitant to try to go back and change any of that. In fact, it was in writing. And you can see that this steward had quite a bit of authority, because when he lost his job, he didn't just kick him out the door. He gave him some time where he still had those books and he was supposed to be getting things in order, and he gave him a little bit of time to train somebody else for the job or whatever, I don't know, but he gave him a little time before he lost his job. And in that period of time is whenever he pulled all this off. Well, at any rate, that's the picture that we have here. And in verse 8, then we have the heart of the parable. We start to get into the heart of the parable. And his master prays. Now, he's not talking about the Lord here, as in the Lord Jesus Christ, but the Lord of the steward. His master prays the unrighteous steward. Now, here's where the name of the parable comes from, the unrighteous steward. And I say I don't think that's a good name for the parable at all, because that's not the point. It doesn't say his master praised the unrighteous steward for his dishonesty. Then you could call it the parable of the unrighteous steward. But it says his master praised the unrighteous steward because he had acted shrewdly. And that's the title of the parable, the shrewd steward. The shrewd steward. This man had acted shrewdly, and that's the point of the story, and it's his shrewdness in the sense of this, exercising foresight, providing, taking action to provide for the future. It's his shrewdness that the Lord wants us to imitate. He exercised foresight. He took provident action before the fact. Now that seems so simple. I mean, obviously, you know, you're facing the fact you're going to lose everything. Try to get something ready for the next step. Now, you know what Jesus says? He says, the children of this age are wiser in their own generation than the children of light. I mean, it's just point blank in front of you. You're going to lose everything. Get ready for it. Get something ready for the next step. And yet every one of us sitting here is going to lose everything. And it's not going to be long. In fact, it could happen in the night like it did for Beth's dad last night. Just in a moment. But even if it's not right now, we know this. We know that we're all going to be put out of the stewardship. We're going to lose everything. So make preparation for the next step. Now, there are a lot of wonderful phrases in this parable, but right here in verse 8, here's two of them. The sons of this age. That's quite a description, isn't it? Some people are just sons of this age. This is what they live. This is where they live. This is all they are. They're just part of this age. This age, this world, is passing away, and the lust thereof. He that doeth the will of God abides forever. But there are sons of this age. And it's a very descriptive term for the people of the world. There are sons of this age, and then there are others that are called sons of light. Sons of light. Now, Jesus says that the sons of this age are more shrewd in relation to their own kind or their own generation than the sons of light. What's that mean? Well, the children of this world go to great lengths to provide for the future, to get money, to have security and that kind of thing. Whereas the children of light oftentimes tend to walk around in a fog in relation to eternal investments and eternal riches and the eternal inheritance. I mean, we get taken up in the things that are this age and don't use wisdom, shrewdness in eternal investments. J.C. Ryle says it may well raise within us great searchings of heart, the diligence of worldly men about the things of time should put to shame the coldness of professing Christians about the things of eternity. That's a good way of saying it, isn't it? The diligence of worldly men about the things of time. Now that's what this parable's about. This man was diligent about the things of time. Jesus says, you be diligent about the things of eternity. That's what he's saying. One reason that I thought that Y2K would not amount to anything was that, in general, the people of the world, they're going to take good care of their money. And so you don't have to worry about them being taken off guard by some computer bug and losing all their money. They are bound and determined to hang on to that money. They're going to be like this good steward, and they're going to go to whatever lengths are necessary in order to make sure that nothing does happen. Now, if we were talking about them being unprepared for spiritual things, we could bank on that. But if you're saying that the whole world is going to be unprepared for material things and money, and they're going to lose all their prosperity, you know, that's a different thing, and that's extremely unlikely, because that's something that people are very concerned about. If they can see it coming. Now, this guy could see it coming. He could see he was going to get put out of his stewardship, and he figured out a way to take care of that. Well, verse 9, the Lord makes his direct application unto us. And I say to you, make friends for yourselves by means of the mammon of unrighteousness, that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal dwellings. Now, this is directly parallel to this parable. And he says, I say unto you, this is the application to you. Now, make friends for yourselves by means of the mammon of unrighteousness. Now, here's another one of these amazing phrases in this parable. Money, according to Jesus, is the mammon of unrighteousness. Every time you talk about how money and so-and-so makes a lot of money and great money and this has got a lot of money, this and that, just fill in the blank. Instead of saying money, say he makes a lot of mammon of unrighteousness. That changes the picture, doesn't it? If I did this, I could get more mammon of unrighteousness. You know, it really changes the picture. A lot. The Bible refers to it in several places. Titus 1:7, 1 Timothy 3:8, 1 Peter 5:2. The King James translation, filthy lucre. Filthy lucre. Now, isn't that a strange way to refer to money? Filthy lucre. The New American Standard isn't much better, and as far as giving a glowing picture here, it's called sordid gain. Sordid. What's that mean? Sordid. So and so has a lot of sordid gain in the bank. I've been saving all my life, and I now have such and such $1,000 worth of sordid gain. That just doesn't sound as good, does it? How much sordid gain do you want for your salary this year? Bob Jennings pointed out to me one time, you know, we say that something is really lucrative. That's filthy lucre. It's very lucrative because it involves filthy lucre. I don't even know what lucre is. Anyway, this is Jesus speaking. This is the Bible speaking. Sordid gain, filthy lucre, mammon of unrighteousness. And the word mammon is capitalized, which some think that it's the name of a god. And so mammon of unrighteousness. Now, I'm going to let you teach me and ask you, why does he call money mammon of unrighteousness? I mean, is money itself, why is it unrighteous? Paul.
Because people who are unrighteous are typically using money as a means to promote their unrighteousness, and then they actually have a tool for unrighteousness.
Okay. That's good. Anybody else have a thought?
The opposite of God. You can't include God in
the world. Okay, that's a good thing. It's a competing God. Okay. Let's see if I have any of that sordid gain in here. What is that? Mammon of unrighteousness. A little piece of mammon of unrighteousness. Any other ideas? All right, the root of all evil. You know, actually, it is filthy lucre because after it passes through a lot of hands, you've got a lot of germs on there. I think that those are the right ideas. I have to put this filthy lucre back into my billfold so I don't forget it. I think the idea is this. It's part of the evil world system tainted by abuse, corruption, dishonesty, and greed. That dollar bill that I just took out, if it's been in circulation very long, it has been associated with all kinds of greed and dishonesty and backstabbing and evil. Isn't that something? I mean, it's just the currency and the flow of this world in evil. That's the basic truth that you can say about it. It's part of an evil world system, tainted by abuse, corruption, dishonesty, and greed. Now, here's the amazing thing. It's possible for a Christian to take that same corrupted, tainted piece of mammon and do something with it that is clean and good and lasts forever. Isn't that amazing? Now, God's saying to us, it says, listen, I gave you this thing. It's not yours. All the resources, of course, this just represents something. It represents a certain number of hours of digging or something. But God says, I give that to you. It's not yours. And I'm going to take it away from you. You can have it for a while. And I'm going to take it away from you, and then I'm going to find out what you did with it while you had it. And Jesus says, look, we just read it here. He says, make friends for yourselves by means of the mammon of unrighteousness, that when it fails, not if it fails, it's going to give out. And every single thing that you have, just like that rich fool last week, then whose will those things be? I mean, you're going to leave it all behind. So he says, it's going to be gone soon. Use it while you can to make friends right now so that when you die, there'll be somebody on the other side waiting there with open arms to receive you. Now, it is actually, there are people that are doing this. Christians are doing it all the time. But there are some people doing it more than others that are using all their wealth. They're going to have a reception. When they die, as soon as they die, they're going to have a reception that's unbelievable of souls. I mean, and if we're giving our money to things like G. John's radio broadcast or Paul Washer or whatever it is to advance the kingdom, we're going to meet people that we don't even know they exist right now. We don't even know their names. And they're going to be rejoicing and greeting us and welcoming us into the kingdom of heaven, because we made friends of them through the money that we gave. The way they were saved was through the advancement of the gospel, in part that came through how we used our resources. Now, I think it was Matthew Henry said something to the effect that we have no idea how many blessings are withheld by God from covetous people. And how many blessings are given, how much is heaped upon those who, what's it say, cast your bread upon the waters and you'll find it after many days. There's a lot of people that have given gifts that don't have any clue of where that ever went at all. But it's going to come back someday. It'll come back someday and be found. First Timothy 6:17-19 gives a similar thought, and this applies to the rich, and in many ways all of us are rich in this country. 1 Timothy 6:17-19. Instruct those who are rich in this present world not to be conceited or to fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly supplies us with all things to enjoy. Instruct them to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share. And verse 19, storing up for themselves the treasure of a good foundation for the future. That's the way to go. I mean, if you want to use this thing in a way that will relate to the future, so that they may take hold of that which is life indeed. It has to do with heaven. Well, verses 10 to 12. He who is faithful in a very little thing is faithful also in much. And he who is unrighteous in a very little thing is unrighteous also in much. If therefore you have not been faithful in the use of unrighteous mammon, who will entrust the true riches to you? And if you've not been faithful in the use of that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? Now, there's some parallels here, and I want to ask you again to answer this. In verse 10, he talks about a very little thing. Now tell me what the parallel is to the very little thing in verse 11. When you get to verse 11, he talks about that very little thing. What is it?
Unrighteous
mammon. Now, someone else tell me, what's the parallel to unrighteous mammon in verse 12? That which is another's. So here's a very little thing, which is the same as unrighteous mammon, which is that which is another's. All right. Next question then. Verse 10 talks about much. He was faithful in a very little thing, faithful also in much. And again at the last half of verse 10, he's unrighteous also in much. So what's the parallel to the much in verse 11? True riches. And somebody else tell me what's the parallel to the true riches in verse 12? That which is your own. So here you have a very little thing, which is the same as unrighteous mammon, which is that which is another's. Here you have much, true riches, and it is your own. Now that's the contrast. Now let's just say a few things here, and then we'll go to verse 13 and we'll close. The first thing is this. Money is another's. Now we've been saying that all down through here, but I mean, this is big. It's revolutionary to see that. I mean, I don't think it's soaked into me. We talk about my this, my that, my house. I can say my house. Well, it's not your house because you could lose it tonight. You know, God will take it away from you. It's His and He can take it back. There are people that have been sitting in their homes. This happened a few years ago, and a piece of plane came down out of the sky and killed them in their home. I mean, it's not yours. This is someone else's. Now, if I could just realize that, well, every time I look at something that's mine, if I could realize this is someone else's. This is someone else's. It's not mine. It's not mine. Now, let me just give you a contrast. You don't need to turn back to this. But listen to the contrast of the way this guy was talking. Shall I then take my bread and my water and my meat that I have slaughtered from my shears and give it to men whose origin I do not know? You remember who said that? Nabal. He was a rich fool. My bread and my water and my meat that I have slaughtered for my shears. I'm not going to give that to some guy running around out here claiming that God is with him and that he's going to be the next king and stuff. Who's he? He didn't share it. Money belongs to another. Second thing, money is a, according to the Lord Jesus, is a very little thing. Now we think, boy, that is a big thing. So-and-so, you know, is a millionaire. Mr. Letourneau was a multimillionaire in heavy equipment. He lived on the 10% and gave away 90%. Say, that's a big thing. Think of what he did. He gave away millions of dollars. Jesus said, that's a very little thing. Now that show, if we think it's a big thing, it shows how much of a hold it has on us, doesn't it? I mean, it's a big thing to us. Jesus said, that's a little thing. You've got to get over that obstacle. You know, that's just a little thing. It's nothing, it's temporary, it's worthless, it's filthy. That's the attitude of the Lord to it. And you see that in his attitude, in the way he lived his life. It meant nothing to him. It had no hold on him at all. He was free. Paul said that's part of the qualification for those in leadership. Free from the love of money. Okay, third thing. There is such a thing as true riches. There are true riches. There's some things that really are worth something. And beloved, when God says something is real, he said this thing is really worth something. We need to be sure it really is. There's some people in this world, Christians, who have riches that are unbelievable. I mean, you talk about wealth. They have unbelievable riches. They have multitudes of souls that they have won. They have graces in their Christian life that are beyond estimating how valuable they are. This is what God says. He said, these are the true riches, and these things are truly riches. Well, the fourth thing, I can have something that is my own. It's possible for me to have something that will never get taken away. Every single thing else will get taken away. But it's possible for me to have some true riches that are eternal, that are my own. Now, Jesus is just flat out saying, if you're not faithful in money, you're never going to have eternal life to be unfaithful in, because it's not going to be given to you. It won't be committed to you. Souls won't be committed to you. You don't have to worry about that. You won't have any fruit in other people's lives because you're not faithful with a little thing. Isn't this something? He's saying here that our proper use of money has to do with how many souls and how much real riches, real things will be committed to us. That's what I was saying, this quote from Matthew Henry. He said, we don't have any idea how many riches, blessings are withheld from the covetous person, because you're not going to get those things committed to you. On the other hand, a person can be poor in this world, but faithful with what he has, and have things, have real, true, mighty riches committed to him and put into his hands. Things that will last forever, things that are my own, things that will never be taken away. Jesus said that Mary has chosen that good part which shall not be taken away from her. Peace I leave with you. My peace I give unto you, not as the world gives, give I unto you. It's not going to be taken away. Well, verse 13. No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will hold to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. Someone said it's like trying to take a right turn and a left turn at the same time. You can't do that. It's impossible. I want to read a quote from Matthew Henry here. He says, if a man will love the world and hold to that, it cannot be but he will hate God and despise him. Now listen to this. He will make all his pretensions of religion truckle to his secular interest and designs. And the things of God shall be made to help him in serving and seeking the world. See, that's how many people is this true of? They are using God to advance their true God. They're serving mammon. But on the other hand, if a man will love God and adhere to him, he will comparatively hate the world whenever God and the world come into competition, and will despise it and make all his business and success in the world some way or other conducive to the furtherance of him in the business of religion. Now look at the difference between the two. Here's a guy using religion to advance himself in the world. Here's the other man using every advancement that he has in the world to help him in serving God better. And you know, we can get into this thing of, you know, someday I'm going to serve God. Right now I've got to get this stuff straightened out. And then someday I'll serve God. And so we give ourselves, ultimately what happens is God bends, the interest of God bends to advancement in the world. What are we to be doing? Let every advancement in the world be used to serve God more. He will make all his business and success in the world some way or other conducive to the furtherance of him in the business of religion. And the things of the world shall be made to help him in serving God and working out his salvation. Now that's something I can ask myself. Are the things of the world helping me to work out my salvation and serve God? The matter is here laid plainly before us. He cannot serve God and mammon. Well, I say to you, make friends for yourselves by means of the mammon of unrighteousness, that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal dwellings. He who is faithful in a very little thing, that is, maybe $1 million, is faithful also in big things, somebody's soul, or things that relate to the kingdom of heaven. He who is unrighteous in a very little thing is unrighteous also in much. If therefore you have not been faithful in the use of unrighteous mammon, who will entrust the true riches to you? If you've not been faithful in the use of that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? Well, may the Lord help us to set our sights on true riches and things that last forever and things that really belong to us, that are our own.